Maureen Killarney, many years ago, my dear old mother sang to me, she sang so sweet and low, just a simple little ditty in her good old Irish way, and I give the world if she could sing that song to me this day.
Years ago, at a pub session in Killarney, I saw a box player, a man from the heart of Slieve Lucre, who visibly winced when he was asked by an American visitor if he would play Tura Lura Lura. The poor tourist was informed, as politely as the offended musician could muster, that Tura Lura Lura, an Irish lullaby, wasn't an Irish song at all, before he broke into a few local jigs in order to demonstrate what he considered the real thing. His reaction reflects a common attitude towards a certain type of song that's identified with a sentimental image of Ireland and a stage Irish cliché. But if we take a closer look at some of those Irish-American songs of variety theatre and vaudeville, a bigger and a more complex picture begins to emerge, and we're rewarded with a story that reveals many rich cultural seams, running parallel with cruel caricatures and a casual racism. It's a story that perhaps for understandable reasons has been swept under the carpet. You see, a song like Tura Lura Lura is part of this story, not so much because it's endured for over 100 years, although that surely counts for something, but because it has connections that reach right back to the early part of the 19th century, back to the era of minstrelsy.
Lura, 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 lura.
The very first singer to record Tura Lura in 1913 was an entertainer by the name of Chauncey Alcott, and he'd begun his career in the blackface minstrel shows that were an incredibly popular phenomena. In fact, at its peak in the 1860s, minstrelsy was nothing short of an industry. There were over 100 national minstrel companies and thousands of small regional ones in America. For many, they offered the possibility of work when work was in short supply, and the Irish were at the centre of minstrelsy from the very beginning. Choreographer and historian Lenny Sloan has been exploring the world of minstrelsy for over 40 years.
In the conversation about minstrelsy, you have to first start with, are we talking about the word minstrel with a small M or with a capital M? If we're talking about the capital M, we're talking about the institution of the minstrel show in America. If we're talking about the small M, we're talking about the phenomena of a theatrical style which rises out of a body of folk art and the contributors to that folk art. If we're talking about minstrel with a capital M, we're talking about an urban art form. We're talking about an urban setting. We're talking about theatricalized and exaggerated dialogue, genre, dance, imagery, symbolism that is taken much like Saturday Night Live or Irish comedy shows that are on the weekend about the topics of the front page of the newspaper. If we're talking about minstrel with a small M, we're talking about the gathering place, the common ground, the crossroads where many cultures came together in whatever little free time they had to share, compare, contrast, compete, with one another in what I call the Great Galactical Cultural Bank. Everybody put something in and everybody took something out.
So it was in the cross-fertilization of cultures, primarily the Irish and African, that minstrelsy had its roots. By the early 1800s, a tradition had developed of blackface itinerant singers, musicians and dancers who performed solo and called themselves Ethiopian delineators.
The Ethiopian delineators' desire was to copy that character that he was playing down to the slightest nuance, voice, patter, stance, attitude, cadence, vernacular, dress, mores, social customs. The Ethiopian delineator went and lived amongst the people, if you will.
One of the very first, Thomas Dartmouth Rice, a travelling actor and playwright, had achieved fame with his signature act, a blackface character called Jim Crow, who was based on a trickster figure popular in the folk tales of black slaves. But it wasn't until 1833 when Irish-American banjo player Dan Emmett, the man who would later be credited with writing Dixie, produced a show together with three other Ethiopian delineators, a show they titled The Essence of Old Virginny, that the group, the Virginia Minstrels, and minstrelsy as a theatrical form was born. Musician, singer and folklorist Mick Maloney has taken a particular interest in the Irish-American arts of the 19th century.
Minstrelsy was America's first popular culture form, and it swept the country. And when minstrelsy went abroad, as it did to Ireland and England, Australia, New Zealand and other places, people thought that this was America. This was American music, and the people on stage were representing black America. To a certain degree, they were, because people like Dan Emmett and all the members of the Virginia Minstrels, they were intimately familiar with black traditions. Dan Emmett lived in Cincinnati. And Cincinnati was a central area for the coming together of Anglo and African American cultures. If you were in Cincinnati, you were in Ohio, and you looked across the Ohio River at the slave state of Kentucky. It was also the home of the Underground Railroad.
Perhaps the Ethiopian delineators were like those white guitar players of the 1960s. People like Eric Clapton and Peter Green or Rory Gallagher here in Ireland, who were genuinely drawn to the sound of the blues and began their careers by emulating that particular African-American style. But the instrument that Dan Emmett was drawn to wasn't the guitar. It was an instrument that has its roots in Africa.
Well, the banjo arrives not literally from West Africa with slavery. It arrives as an idea. Because the slaves carried literally nothing with them, but they carried the idea of an instrument which is still played today in West Africa. And basically the prototype is sort of shadowy, but it involves strings, a long neck, and a body. It could be a gourd or a makeshift, very ramshackle, perhaps a wooden contraption. But what's involved is strings stretched and tuned and played with a percussive downward motion by the left or right hand, depending upon, the player, to accompany singing or dancing and to play fairly rudimentary melodies. And this was called the banzi, the banje, the banza. It seemed always to start with B-A-N. the banjo then becomes appropriated by these Irish Americans and other Americans in minstrelsy, and becomes the dominant central instrument in minstrelsy. Everything is focused on the banjo and the fiddle. It was either African or Irish, maybe English and Scottish too, or various combinations of influences from both cultures. So the music is fascinating, and I suppose in one sense, like Appalachian music, you could say that it combines the melodic traditions of the Celtic world, or the Gaelic world in particular, with the backbeat of Africa. And you can't understand old-time music or bluegrass or minstrel music without looking at those two central components, rhythmic and melodic, from both worlds. And they forge the foundation of what's now called American folk music, and especially instrumental music. The dancing is part of that too. But the banjo then becomes the symbol of minstrelsy. Everything is built around the banjo, and there's one of my favourite books on the banjo by Karen Lynn is called The Half-Barbaric Twang. And it was the minstrels who were formed here, the Virginia minstrels here in New York, just a few blocks from where we're talking, on the Bowery in 1833, essentially by Irish Americans, and Dan Emmett would have been, I suppose, the most famous of them all. These were Ethiopian delineators. They're solo performers who made a living before blackface and then after blackface on the American stage. Virtuoso musicians, fiddlers, singers, dancers, and instrumentalists too, and all of them play the banjo to some degree, especially Dan Emmett. And a man called Joel Walker Sweeney, whose antecedents, like Dan Emmett's, came from Mayo. And the banjo then becomes the first American folk instrument, basically appropriated by Americans, mostly Irish Americans, from African roots.
That they didn't intend to invent a form. They came together because they were kind of out of work, and they said, let's all play together. But they advertised it as a complete evening of the oddities, the comicalities, the eccentricities, and the musicalities of that sable genius of humanity. And they made a form. They forged a style of the group as opposed to the itinerant solo artist.
I play the banjo, it's my main instrument, and I've always been attracted to the wildness of the sound of it. And the more, I didn't know anything about the history of it when I heard the Dunn brothers play in the streets of Limerick and O'Connell Street when I was growing up, and playing at sporting events as well. They were travellers, and some of the great colourful characters I met, Barney McKenna, the Pecker Dunn. They loved the banjo because of the fact that there was something slightly subversive about it, on the edge, and it attracts a certain kind of personality. Or used to back in the 60s. There were very few banjo players around then. I was attracted to it because of the wildness of it. I didn't even know the word subversive at the time. But I was to learn later on, especially after meeting Lenny, which I did in America, that it always was on the edge of society. I mean, minstrelsy was working class. It was, in one sense, a revolt against European high culture. So you have to look upon it as almost like a defiant American working class statement. In a way, almost accidentally, it involved blackface. But something like minstrelsy was bound to occur as a revolt by Americans against the kind of trumped up elitist notion of what was good in culture. To say, we're just as good as you are in Europe, we're not as highfalutin, you know, we may not be performing opera on stage, but we're doing something that's ours, and by God, it's good. Yankee Doodle Dandy, you know, came out of that tradition. And
And you know, Tambo and Bones loved to catch the interlocutor in his highfalutin ways. The audience roared when Tambo and Bones would expose the stuffiness of the interlocutor. Mick is talking about subversiveness. There was a long period, particularly in Congo Square in New Orleans, where the drums were outlawed because they excited the enslaved to riotous behavior. So the form of padding, juba, comes about. And the shuffling and padding juba, which Thomas Dartmouth Rice was a master at the padding juba. We call it hambone now. But it's to actually replace with parts of the body the different drums that were outlawed. And so these inventions come out of suppression. And every time you suppress these two people, they invented something new.
And both in Irish and in African American culture, you know, it's using the body as a last resort when you're when you are oppressed to the point where literally it's the last thing you own is your own body. So you have to see padding juba in a continuum that extends to the hunger striker and the suicide bomber. It's all part of the same act of using your body as a perceived last resort against oppression. So when you start to look at subversion and how the banjo fits into that, the banjo's always been there on the edge along with the body, looked down upon by people who are so refined, although there's this ironic moment where well-dressed ladies from the upper classes would play in the banjo, all-female banjo orchestras around the turn of the century, which was a huge part of kind of post-Victorian culture. But you have those ironic moments. But generally speaking, it's the music of the working class, whether it's bluegrass or whether it's the Irish banjo, which takes, after the Virginia minstrels go to Ireland in the year before the famine, 1844, you have the formal introduction of the banjo to Ireland, but it only catches on among the travelling people. And for almost a century, the banjo becomes the instrument of the travellers in Ireland, played by settled people too, of course. But it's a loud instrument. It's a happy instrument. It'll get people's attention, like Christy Dunn playing in the streets of Limerick. You could hear from one end of the street to the other. And it becomes a tool of the wretched of the earth to, first of all, say we're here, and secondly, maybe make us some kind of a living. And minstrelsy was as much about that as anything else, making, scratching out a living.
I wonder if Margaret Barry was aware of the history of her instrument as she tried to scratch out a living in the 1940s when she was a young woman travelling the roads of Ireland on her bicycle to play at fair days and patron days and for the queues outside cinemas and football matches.
For the sake of health, I took a walk one morning in the dark. I met a jolly turf man on the road as I went on. A friendly conversation came between that man and me, and that's how I came in.
You know, a lot of historians are rethinking minstrelsy now, and Lenny and I, you know, found out, and Lenny more than I would have known, that these white Ethiopian delineators, many of whom are Irish American, like Dan Emmett and Joel Walker Sweeney, they were intimately familiar with black culture. They turned to the corn shuckings, the harvest rituals. They hung out with blacks. They stole from blacks. Dan Emmett, when he wrote Dixie, I mean, there's a big controversy. Did he steal it from a famous family called the Snowden family, a black family who were in Ohio? Did he steal it or did he not? Everyone was appropriating from everybody.
Right. That's what I talk about, the great galactical bank, where blacks and Irish came together in the middle of the square and everyone made a deposit and a withdrawal from that galactical bank, you know. And it's why our American minstrel form is Afro-Gaelic culture, you know.
The unfortunate part of it is that there was an imbalance in power. And as the Irish distanced themselves more, and white people generally, from black culture, and the racism grew more intense, there's a power imbalance which is ugly. And it ceased to be democratic at that point, really, as the power balance shifted, and there was nothing democratic about that. But if you look at the internal elements, the art is pure. It's what people do with it that's not that is not savory. And, you know, Irish stereotypes proliferate to this day. The drunken Irishman, the Irishman who mangles the English language just as much as the interlocutor in blackface mangled the English language. The Irish person with the bulls and the puns. This goes way back to Ben Jonson in the early 17th century or the late 16th century. When look at the play The Masque, there's a stage Irishman there long before it was in America. It starts out in England. Anytime there's an oppressed group, you're going to find stereotypification, or you're going to find manipulation of the truth. What I like to do, and I think what Lenny likes to do, is you know, the rehabilitation moments come in the art. And artists, you know, our motives, generally speaking, when we're just being artists, are pure enough. We just try to create something of beauty. And when you hear old-time music with the banjo and the fiddle play to this day, the purity of the sound, which incorporates that African backbeat, and the beautiful, they're transformed now, but those melodic traditions that came from either Scotland or Ireland or parts of England, Scandinavia, Germany perhaps too. There's a beauty to that that transcends its history and that transcends the context. And it's that search for beauty, you know, that every artist really, at core, that's what drives, that's what makes you do what you do.
Gonna build me a log cabin on a mountain so high so I can see Willie as she goes walking by. Oh, the cuckoo, she's a pretty bird, Lord, she warbles as she flies. She'll never say cuckoo till the 4th day of July.
In the minstrel period, we were trying to lift up one set of people by destructing the other. You know, we were lifting up, your condition may be bad, but look at this guy, you know. Now, it's also interesting that Irishmen take on this black face. There are lots and lots of reports which don't make it into our history and our memory about the use of blackface as a form of rioting. The Shea Rebellion, the Irish in Vermont, the Paxton Boys of Pennsylvania blacking themselves up and that blackface mask was also a mask of rebellion, you know. Well, in the minstrel show it became rebellious humor. I could say all kind of things because it wasn't really me saying it. It was this black guy saying it, you know. And so we all laughed together. But in the laughing, we learned and we consented. Sometimes that was about westward movement. Sometimes it was about putting down the Indians. Sometimes it was about taxing whiskey. Sometimes it was about taking jobs of black coal miners and giving them to Irishmen. Sometimes it was about fighting on both sides. But the mask of blackness became a legitimate way that Irishmen, especially in America, could say some fiercely political things about the masters and arbiters of their destiny through the fundamental humor and buffoonery of a black man.
One songwriter in minstrelsy towers above all others. His songs like O Susanna and the Camptown Races are so ubiquitous as to have entered the realm of folk song, while others, such as Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair and Beautiful Dreamer, are still perennials on the concert stage. Stephen Foster's grandparents were from Derry and he was born and bred in Pittsburgh. His songs easily broke free of the confines of the minstrel stage, and when a visiting Italian opera singer performed for Abraham Lincoln, Foster's material was considered a suitable choice.
When the Adelina Patti sang Old Folks at Home at Congress, Congress made her sing this song 14 times. 14 times, they say. They unhitched the horses of her wagon afterwards and drew her, each man pulling her carriage to her hotel. Stephen Foster, we don't do song cycles anymore. We think of these three songs as three separate songs. Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair, Beautiful Dreamer, and Come Where My Love Lies Dreaming. But they were sung in cycle of the three songs. Families would sing them after dinner, you know. I mean, they all knew the parts, you know. And so this music really impacted the lives of people. It was part of the texture of their lives and part of the common experience of their work day.
Like the old folks at home, idealized life on the plantation where everyone was happy and the master was kindly. And by implication, these songs could be seen as justifying slavery. Although it should be said that the segregationists weren't happy with aspects of minstrelsy either, because they believed the runaway slave was often portrayed with too much sympathy. None of these things go in absolutely straight lines. However, there's no denying the overall tone of the setting in which Foster's minstrel songs appeared.
The unfortunate thing about them is that they have so much baggage around them. And Lenny was talking about the beauty of the music and the singing in minstrelsy. It's all been compromised by the baggage of racism. And it's very hard to rescue, especially in the climate of multiculturalism that we aspire to today and respect for diversity. It's very hard to rehabilitate some of this material. You know, you can change the N-word to African, but you're still not going to quite remove it from its context, which was highly racial. But Foster, there's not a singer or musician today, just whatever their ethnicity, that doesn't adore Foster songs. And he was, among other things, the first white songwriter ever to call an African-American woman a lady.
Yes. This is a beautiful song, you know. Miss Nellie was a lady, you know. I mean, no one referred to a black woman as a lady. In fact, she never even had a last name. And he gives her full name in the song. It's nothing to us now, but it was a highly political act to elevate this black woman to being a whole person. For me, Stephen Foster, now, you know, I'm a Pittsburgh boy, so Old Black Joe was a song that has moved in and out of my life for all these years.
Why do I weep when my heart should feel no pain? Why do I sigh that my friends come not again?
First we sang it, then we didn't. Then we sang it again when we found ourselves in the folk music. You know, then we didn't sing it again when we were in the 70s Black Power movement. You know, the song is the same, but the foreground and background, the social condition in which the song is accepted, changed. And so we've changed our opinion about Old Black Joe. So you have to always look at the viewer of the minstrel show as well as the content of the show. Because what did he or she come to this show to learn or find out?
I'm coming, for my head is bent and low. I hear those gentle voices calling. Poor old Joe.
Foster's songs comfortably straddled two very different worlds.
In the songs by Stephen Foster, Beautiful Dreamer, Come Where My Love Lies Dreaming, he is portraying the lounge and salon of the aristocrat. Where in some of the other songs that he sings, he is showing the rough dirt plank wood life of the common man. And this minstrel show of the Stephen Foster era is a tug of war between these two economies. He captures both of them very well in the verses and the courses of the music that he created.
Better fall than life's pleasures and count its many tears, while we all suffer sorrow with the poor. There's a song that will linger forever in our ears. Our hard times come again no more.
Stephen said that Hard Times was based on fragments of spirituals he'd heard as a child in the African-American church where the family nurse Olivia Peace worshipped.
Hard Times is the deepest blues pathos piece that I think that Stephen Foster ever wrote. The song itself is played, portrayed, and performed in three very different ways. The first way for the minstrel stage as a sing-along, where the audience sings with them. We all sing that, you know, we're down and out, but we're gonna get through this. The second way it was sung was by the soldiers on both sides of the Civil War, both the North and the South, the Confederates and the Union, sang Hard Times. It was a what are we in this for? What are we doing this for? The folly of the war in the middle of the battle where 500,000 men died and brothers killed brothers and fought against brothers. So the song takes up a hopelessness. But the third way it was sung, very near the end of Stephen Foster's life, and the way it comes into many song cycles and performances today, is the deepest, bluesiest hopelessness and poverty. 'Tis the song, the sigh of the weary, hard times, come again no more. Many days you have lingered around my cabin door. Oh, hard times, come again no more. Anybody who has really felt hunger, I mean, really, you know, this is an anthem for the hopeless in the final. And so the song mutates by the singer and by the condition and the times.
is the song, the sigh of the
Theatre was the next development in American entertainment, and alongside the acrobats, magicians, and comic sketches, there were also songs that reflected the social issues facing the audience.
We have a long-standing tradition in Ireland of expressing just about every social, political, cultural concern we have through music or song. And it's not a very complex thought, but it's a reality. It was one of the few outlets we had to express our point of view when just about everything else is closed. And that tradition continued in America. And songwriters like Ned Harrigan, who was really the most prolific of all the songwriters, born here in New York. His grandfather was from Cork and settled in Newfoundland. And Ned Harrigan, who was a minstrel in his early musical career, his prime trade, again, a working class trade, it was a ship's caulker, which was a swell trade, making ships waterproof, which was, of course, essential. It was kind of, would be, you know, a skilled trade equivalent to an electrician or a bricklayer today, or a carpenter, a fine carpenter. But his passion was to perform, a banjo player, a dancer, a singer. But he was a songwriter. He started off as a minstrel, playing with a group called Campbell's Minstrels, one of the top minstrel groups in New York. But he left minstrelsy not because he was upset with the racism of it. That wasn't something that entered the picture with working class people. It was something you grew up with, you accepted it. It was because it was a restricted format artistically. There was only so much you could do in blackface. It was also all male. And Harrigan, it wasn't just that minstrelsy became less fashionable after the Civil War. Racism was alive and well in America for a long time after the Civil War, and to a certain degree still is. It was the restricted format, and artists tire of restricted formats. You want to go over the wall and try something else. And variety theatre afforded that possibility. Later on, vaudeville, where you could have animal acts on the stage, jugglers, contortionists, anything that made people laugh and entertained a multicultural audience that didn't necessarily have competence in the English language as immigration became more widespread in American urban life. There were traces of the stereotype. I mean, perception is a funny thing. You have to categorize people just to live in a city, to map your terrain, to know who you are. You have to, you know, exercise your powers of perception, and often they're not necessarily harmful, to recognize the differences between you and somebody else and the similarities. But when carried to a certain extreme, they become stereotypes which are harmful. The Irish live with stereotypes in America as a marginal oppressed group, and they live beside the blacks, as Lenny Sloan has taught me. For many, many decades, we were almost, in a sense, forced by American capitalism to become racist. Not that we didn't adapt very quickly to it and very well, we sure did, and we have to take responsibility for that. But it was almost an inevitable dynamic that came out of capitalism. Those stereotypes were basically a way of projecting them. They were basically a way of making money. You know, when you think of the Irish today in St. Patrick's Day parades, you think of drinking and fighting to this day. And I've met so many hundreds of young teenagers who say, we got to go and get drunk because it's St. Patrick's Day. And I say to them, are you Irish American? No. Well, why are you going to get drunk? Because that's what you do. So these images last a long time, and these stereotypes, they're played out in a variety of ways in vaudeville, and there were stereotypes about every ethnic group at one point or another. And they were all played out on the American stage. It wasn't necessarily to black up and do that, although, as Lenny has often said, if you blacked up, you could say and do anything.
You know, it's very interesting because this notion of white men blacking their face goes all the way back to Greek and Roman theater. Some of the highest paid actors in Shakespeare's time were the people who played Othello or who played the Prince of Morocco in The Merchant of Venice, you know, who is courting Portia, and his opening speech is, mislike me not for my complexion, the shadowy liver of my burnished face. You know, these guys played black men. And to play these characters, particularly in Shakespeare's time, was to study as close as you could the nuance, the pattern. That's what I was saying about the Ethiopian delineators. They were trying to be black. They were not caricatures of black. That comes later. They were trying to bring as best they could the nuance. You know? So the evolution of men through Thomas Dartmouth Wright, Jim Crow, to Dan Emmett and the Virginia Minstrels, to the Christie Minstrels, to Haverly's 30 Black and 30 White, to Harrigan and Hart. It's a long tradition of putting soot on your face. Even the Paxton boys who blackened up and tried to kidnap George Washington, you know, because it was a band of black men who were trying to kidnap George Washington. So that use of that soot as a political instrument, you know, gets mixed up with the exchange and the free swapping in the commonplace where two oppressed people who work is the only thing. They work, and then they work some more. So this song, this dance, this contest, this joke, this is a break from oppression, you know. And inside of that moment, which I call the crossroads, comes an outside force that manipulates those two for the political purpose, you know, and the advancement of all kinds of everything from selling soap to selling votes, you know.
Ned Harrigan was known as the Molière or the Dickens of New York because he invented a kind of theatre that was social realism. He gave New York back to itself.
His audience was mostly Irish Americans for the first few decades of his career, so he had to be deadly accurate. He even went and bought the costumes off the backs of immigrants arriving in Castle Garden and Ellis Island. So you could arrive in America and you'd sell your shirt, you'd see it on stage the following Thursday night. And that's how realistic Harrigan was in his depiction of characters. He wrote a lot about it. And he had in the Mulligan Guard plays, was a whole series of them, recognisable characters and animosities, say, between the Irish and the Germans who lived beside one another on the edges of the Five Points. And in a fairly jovial way were competitors in early American urban capitalism. And he had them in the Mulligan Guard, the mostly Irish competing with the Germans. But then, as a parallel institution in the Mulligan Guard series of plays, he had the Skidmore Guards, which were blacked up Irish Americans for the most part. And they were same cast, so some additional ones. And they were all, practically all of the plays ended in a drunken melee or a brawl or a roustabout. But everyone remained standing at the end. And it was like the plays of the old Hindu traditions that are played out in Indonesia, where the forces of perceived good and evil always remain intact at the end, so they'll fight again another day. It's not a question of good and evil fighting one another. It's a question of showing that a part of the human fabric.
I am a man of great influence and educated to a high degree. I came once small from Donegal, and me cousin Jimmy came along with me. On the city road I was situated, in a lodging house with me brother Dan, till by perseverance I elevated, and I went to the front like a solid man. So come with me and I will treat you decent, I'll sit you down and I will fill your can. And along the street all the friends I meet say there goes Muldoon, he's a solid man.
When Ned Harrigan was writing most of his songs, his early songs in the 1870s, one out of every two people you'd meet in Manhattan was Irish-born. His primary audience at that point in his writing was Irish. So he wrote songs like Muldoon the Solid Man to represent what was an emergent force in American urban politics, which was the force of the Irish in early Tammany. Tammany Hall, which is the hallmark of the Democratic Party's stranglehold over urban American politics for decades. And he depicted in many of his songs the power of the alderman, who basically never missed going to a funeral. He never missed a christening. He never missed the arrival of a new immigrant into the community, because he knew his survival depended upon knowing, you know, everything that was going on in his district and being connected as much as possible closely to everybody. So he wrote songs. Harrigan wrote songs about these political figures. His most famous was Muldoon the Solid Man, but the one I like best is Old Boss Barry. And basically he's talking about this figure that would be described as corrupt, I suppose, in any political system today. But as Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan said in his extraordinary book, Beyond the Melting Pot, which really set the hallmark for looking at America in the context of a plural society rather than a society where everything would be melted together, he said, well, the Irish ward politician has been kind of reviled as being a corrupt figure, but he said famously, he only took 10% and everything worked.
He's a dude in the ward, and he's perfectly adored by those in the front and in the rear. To his constituents he speaks with eloquence, so flowingly beside a keg of beer. For the county and the state he's the maker of the slate, a leader, do you hear me, through and through. Sure, the rank and the file, they all greet him with a smile, saying, Old Boss Barry, how'd you do? Then it's Old Boss Barry, how'd you do? Is there anything that we can do for you? Come tell us of your plan, we're with you to a man. Old Boss Barry, how'd you do?
Old Boss Barry is my favourite Harrigan song about politics. But he wrote a lot of songs about the figure of the Irish as industrious, hardworking, and as the backbone of American urban society. You know, there were people who wrote songs of one of the most famous songs of the era, which was made famous by the creator or the inventor of vaudeville, Tony Pastor, who was actually a Latino American with no Irish background, whatever. His most famous song was No Irish Need Apply, protesting against the discrimination against the Irish in jobs in America, a very restricted area of jobs available to the newly arrived Irishmen, as indeed there was to African Americans as well. We shared an awful lot of similar experiences when it came to discrimination. The song No Irish Need Apply, it became one of the most popular songs in vaudeville, and Pastor had to sing it practically at every concert he did for years. That the song No Irish Need Apply was written by John Poole, who was the same man that wrote Tim Finnegan's Wake, which is the ultimate stereotype of the drunken Irishman falling down, getting dead drunk and literally being considered dead until he arises magically from his torpor when whiskey spills over him, Ishka Baha, the water of life. How could James Joyce have resisted that? as the title. You know, the bricklayer, the builder of civilization. Finn again, you know, Finn McCool back again, revised from the dead. And, of course, Ishkabaha, the water of life. The three ultimate metaphors that Joyce pounces on as the title of his most famous and most abstruse work. But all these songs came out of the experience of the Irish at the very lowest level of American society, clawing themselves up after the famine against the anti-Catholic discrimination of the time, and also drawing themselves further away from the tenements that they would have shared not too many years earlier with African Americans.
Towards the end of the 19th century, there's another twist.
As black men are entering the American stage, black men have to play Irish men playing black men, talking about white condition in America. So you get Reuben Crowder from St. Louis, a black man, who comes to New York, changes his name to Ernest Hogan so that he can enter the minstrel shows, blacks his light-skinned face up so you don't know he's black anyway, and then begins to talk about voters' rights, you know, and suppression of voters' rights. And he's caught, you know, he writes a song, All Coons Look Alike to Me. For the longest time, I used to call it Tutte Cuni Me Resemble in Italian because I just couldn't wrap myself around You All Look Alike. Boy, is that ever a slogan, you know, They All Look Alike to Me. Ernest got $100 for that song. He put that $100 in his pocket. That was a lot of money. The song became so popular, it was printed as sheet music in the New York Times Sunday supplement. And children went around New York whistling, All Coons Look Like to Me. It perpetrated a stereotype that we're still trying to scrub off of ourselves.
One of the most shameful musical chapters in American history was the couple of decades which featured, all you have to do is go through the record catalogs, literally thousands of what were called officially coon songs. I've always felt uncomfortable using that term, and only when I do public presentations with Lenny do I even venture into that territory as a, you know, as a privileged, relatively privileged white person in American society. It makes me uncomfortable to even say the word. But coon songs became almost obsolete in terms of the lexicon of songwriting when Irving Berlin, the Jewish songwriter who marries Ellen Mackay, the Irish-American, who's the granddaughter of John Mackay, who discovers the Comstock Lode, becomes one of the first successful Irish millionaires in American history. This Dublin-born person who just literally strikes silver. When Irving Berlin marries Ellen Mackay, he's marrying a woman that is attracted him in part because he's such a successful songwriter. And one of his big first hits was Alexander's Ragtime Band. And when he writes, "And if you want to hear the Swanee River played in ragtime," now that's a genius of a line, syncopated, which coon songs, if you want to call them that, but certainly the term that replaced coon songs was ragtime. "And if you want to hear the Swanee River," that's all syncopated African rhythm. "And if you want to hear the Swanee River played in ragtime," which is not syncopated, it has the octave jump, ragtime, the Scotch snap, da-dum. It's the most breathtakingly brilliant line in American songwriting up to that point. Talking 1912, and you're talking a genius, the American songwriter, like Stephen Foster. He's an American songwriter. But seeing the irony, if you want to hear the Swanee River, the theme of minstrelsy, played in ragtime, which is non-syncopated. What a genius of a line.
Come on in here.
I'll leave the final reflection to Lenny Sloan.
40 years now of my 70 years, I have been involved in the exploration of minstrel shows. But the only thing I know is that the music and the dance is the pure thing. You know, the jokes, the vernacular, the costumes, the politics, the satire change, but the music and the dance, somehow in the middle of the tune, you know, the politics falls away and we're back to the common ground again. And I think that's what the Irish spirit and the African heart found in each other, is the common ground. Yeah.
Common Ground was presented and produced by JJ O'Shea for RTE Lyric FM. The contributors were African-American choreographer Lenny Sloan and the Irish folklorist and musician Mick Maloney. The programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland from the television licence fee.